Hi, Karen Smith here, and welcome to lesson number 2 of module 1. Today we're going to look at some of the factors that significantly affect NGOs as they're working at the United Nations. Now, to do this, I want to first look at context. We will go into specific details of the United Nations, its structure, the charter, its organs, and how they work. And that will further enhance your understanding of the environment that you're working in. Part of what we want to look at is how NGOs can actually work effectively in this environment. So, of course, the context is critical for our understanding. Context is something that deals with history, with demographics, with the networks that are already at play within that community. And many of those networks, quite frankly, you cannot so easily see. They're almost invisible. They're a little bit like the networks of cell phone users, and whether it be Sprint or AT&T or T-Mobile, whatever, you can't see them, but they're all busy working even as you walk into the United Nations itself. And similarly, as you walk into the United Nations or engage in any of the United Nations activities, invisibly around you, there are networks of activity going on that in the end, sooner or later, you need to become aware of if, in fact, you are to be very strategic in your work and able to affect the kind of change that you want. Now, frankly, the United Nations is far more complex than anyone can totally predict. However, if you were to go there and begin doing your work, whether it's PR or advocacy, or whether you're trying to hold governments accountable on some particular issue, if you are unaware of the influence and the impact of many of these networks and how they work, many things will happen that just will be inexplicable to you. So I want to at least begin to introduce to you some of these other dynamics that are at play that will influence your interaction with diplomats, representatives of different UN agencies, people who work at the United Nations in the various departments or committees or organs of the United Nations. The fact is, as an individual, we go to the United Nations, we begin to interact, and our interactions are one-on-one. They are one person to another. However, behind that, immediately behind that person, there are many dynamics that are at play. And to be effective, we have to begin to become aware of these and take these into consideration in our planning, strategies, and very definitely in our direct interaction with those people. So context is going to be a huge factor in influencing your effectiveness and your NGO's effectiveness at the United Nations. Here we are at First Avenue. Whoever took this picture, and it's one of the pictures from the United Nations Resource Library, which you can have access to. You just have to also give acknowledgement that these resources are from the United Nations Photo Library. And we can put that link up in your resource area. You'll find it there. But you walk along First Avenue and you'll see the buildings and the flags. This is the General Assembly. Some of these pictures are just to give you a little bit of a sense. I'm sure many of you have seen these or have walked through these areas yourself. And so you know not only what they look like, but you know a little bit about what you feel like. But NGOs go to the United Nations to work at the global level, to set agendas, fast-track an issue or two, or hold governments accountable to previous promises. Working at the global level can have enormous benefits for NGOs, and this is why many do go to the United Nations. And this, just taking this very quickly, there is an excellent book by Felix Dodds and Michael Strauss. You can get it on Amazon or wherever, How to Lobby at Intergovernmental Meetings. We'll review some of the points that they have made in a later program, later lesson, but also I will add in other components based on my own experience of lobbying at the intergovernmental level. Now, the United Nations set up at its inception Article 71 of the UN Charter. It kept a door open to allow civil society or non-governmental organizations to be able to engage at the United Nations. So this has been in the very framework of the UN since its beginning in 1945. Since then, in Resolution 1996, the UN has further refined the ways in which NGOs, and in particular in consultative status with the Economic and Social Council, or ECOSOC, are able to interact. For now, I'll just give you a link to this particular document, because we're going to go over in a later lesson how to really utilize the UN documents area. You can download that and look at it when you want to look at the details. You will find at times that it is necessary to deal with and to know very specifically what a number of the resolutions say, especially as they pertain to NGOs, but beyond that too for other areas as you work on issue areas or some aspect of lobbying. Now, this particular resolution outlines the process of becoming formally associated with the United Nations in consultative status with the Economic and Social Council. It outlines what needs to be done. It addresses the issue of NGOs being reviewed and being held, needing to prove and show that they are still in good standing, consistently with when they first applied, those kinds of things. So again, through the NGO section of ECOSOC, you can find a little bit more about that. But the main point here is just to say that ever since the beginning of the UN and since then, there have been very specific resolutions of the United Nations that outline the eligibility requirements, the rights and obligations of NGOs in consultative status, the role and function of the ECOSOC Committee on NGOs and what it has to do. It's a 19-country committee. The responsibilities of the UN Secretariat in supporting the consultative relationship for NGOs at the United Nations, as well as, and here it just mentions the 19 member states, and you can find also on the website the specific 19 members that do sit on the NGO committee at that time. This is just suffice to say that if your NGO does have ECOSOC status, you've already been through a process. Your NGO has already been through quite a vetting process during which 19 countries have basically agreed on behalf of the United Nations, on behalf of all of the member states of the United Nations, have agreed that your NGO is worthy of being associated with the United Nations. Now, there are other ways to be in a formal relationship with the United Nations and informal relationship with the United Nations. So there's four basic ways, to formal and to informal. And I just introduced that of consultative status with the Economic and Social Council. Now, part of the reason why I mentioned that one first is that this is the kind of status or the relationship that gives an NGO the largest scope of ability to impact, work with, and be involved in the United Nations in a formal way. For example, organizations with general consultative status may propose new items for consideration by the Economic and Social Council itself. Essentially, the rights and privileges enumerated in the Economic and Social Council Resolution 1996/31 enables the qualifying organizations to make a contribution to the work, programs, and goals of the UN by serving as technical experts, advisors, consultants to governments and the Secretariat. Now, sometimes as advocacy groups, they espouse UN themes, implementing plans of actions, programs, and declarations adopted by the United Nations. And in concrete terms, this entails their participation in ECOSOC and its various subsidiary bodies through attendance at these meetings, through oral interventions, written statements on agenda items of those bodies, and more. Now, NGOs with DPI status, that is, those who have been formally associated with the Department of Public Information, really are committing to disseminating UN information out into the world beyond the UN bounds. Bottom line, this is an agreement with the United Nations that says, yes, Mr. United Nations, as an NGO in association with DPI, we have a considerable number of members and people. We have media outlets. We have email lists. We have newsletters and ways that we can get your information out into different segments of our global population. And then you have to articulate to DPI which ones those are. But there's no agreement here that you can have formal relations at the United Nations beyond this task of disseminating UN information. This particular form of association with the United Nations. Now, the UN recognizes that in order for an organization to disseminate information well, they have to have access, certain amounts of access to the United Nations and the resources and information that it has. So the United Nations does allocate a couple of UN grounds passes to those organizations in association with DPI. Now, the two less formal ways are by getting accreditation for a conference, a summit, or some other organized event that's been organized by the United Nations, or by establishing working relations with a particular UN department, program, or specialized agencies. And in the resources, we'll list some of those. But the fact is here is you don't have to have formal accreditation with the United Nations in order to establish working relations, especially out in the field. So some key areas for NGOs that are not necessarily based in New York or have an office in New York or in Geneva, Vienna, or in Nairobi, the four main locations for UN offices, then they can still interact through these various means. Again, we'll go over this, we'll give you more information, more links, more connections, but at this stage we're still just beginning to introduce you to some of the UNEs, and gradually it will become more meaningful. Now, as we go through the structure of the United Nations and develop a better understanding of how many of the parts of the United Nations work together and what it is that those different organs do and can do, then you'll also get a better sense of what it is that NGOs can do at the United Nations. Gaining more clarity about what can be done, how NGOs can work, and what the options are is very important because some, depending on their goals and objectives, in reality may discover that the investment of personnel and resources that is required at the United Nations really may not be the best use of the resources that they have available. It may not really further their main objectives and agenda. On the other hand, as you get to know the structure and the way things normally work, you can also see there is, in fact, a lot of flexibility of how to work to get agendas heard or issues on the table. You don't always have to go the formal route. And the United Nations is not meant to be this watertight entity that is isolated completely from the rest of the world other than for the totally formal mechanisms that have been in place. It's not set up that way. It will never be that way. And even today, there are ways to still be active and to impact the UN community and the global community through your work as an NGO. And again, by understanding the norms, the established formal structures, you can also better work out for your NGO and for your agendas what are the best strategies and ways for you to work. So let's continue on. Just a reminder here that the United Nations is perhaps the preeminent, but it is not the only intergovernmental meeting place for nations. In fact, there are many other IGOs or intergovernmental organizations. And again, we provide a link for you, and there are other places to research. All you have to do is Google international governmental organizations or IGOs on the internet, and you can find many more. But this is just one site that goes ahead and lists a lot of those intergovernmental organizations. And so what's the point of this? Many countries who are members of the United Nations are also members of many of these other IGOs. But what's the relevance of that?
It just means that not all governments will pursue all of the issues that their country has at the United Nations. they may partition some of their agenda and do some of that work in other locations. So depending on your NGO's focus, you may discover that a different IGO may in fact be something that you need to either include in your plans for work or even possibly shift from focusing on the UN to another IGO. So that's all just to say that some of these other IGOs will impact some aspects of the work at the United Nations. And very clearly, they will also impact the political process amongst and between the member states at the United Nations. What goes on in those other IGOs will impact, for better or for worse, some of the specifics of what goes on at the United Nations. Part of my point here is to point you in directions that can give you ideas about how to be more effective in your communications and in your endeavors to influence diplomats in some way. At least by being aware of their larger context, it can give you an edge. It can give you ideas about how to better relate. It can give you directions within which to research and possibly to gain additional information that can allow you to leverage your organization with that country in some way. And to remind you that when we do go to the United Nations, we go virtually as guests of governments and therefore need to adjust our strategies accordingly. Calling NGOs the guests of governments is probably not quite the right way to describe the actual relationship. However, many to most of the governments feel that way, and that's what we have to take into consideration as we deal with the governments at the United Nations. So what is your NGO's agenda? NGOs have a multitude of agendas. Development, crime, environment, human rights, governance, indigenous issues, youth, religious tolerance, trafficking, victims, poverty, HIV, corruptions, and I haven't even begun to break the surface. There are many, and then you can drill right down into specific areas of all of these different agendas and issues. And as NGOs, we tend to be lumped in one bucket, so to speak, by member states. But that one bucket may not fit all NGOs very well. But again, we just have to say that this is one of the perspectives that is sometimes held by many of the diplomats or people who work in different areas of the United Nations. Now, here in this little piece, I just want to show that the attitude towards NGOs has been mixed over the years. Of course, when the United Nations was first established, they were clearly given a way to formally relate with the United Nations because the role of civil society is valued. Throughout the years, and especially I think you can see from this article, relates to the WTO event in Seattle and back in 1999. And that's when the NGOs got together and disrupted the proceedings of the WTO. Now, the WTO isn't the United Nations. However, what that did is it brought to a new peak level the capacity of civil society to interact at the global level with governmental organizations and even shut them down for a few days. As you can see in part of this article, it says, do they represent a dangerous shift in power, or are they some of the first steps towards an international civil society? If you go to the United Nations, speak to some of the diplomats, you'll find some of them genuinely value the majority of NGOs. Of course, they know to be wary of some. That's a normal attitude. And there are some other governments who really just, across the board, pretty much do not think that NGOs should be at the United Nations. And I say that not to create any major warnings in your mind, but to mostly just to say, again, context. Some of the people that you will meet, even if they really like NGOs, they don't necessarily just open-armed embrace all NGOs because they know that people in NGOs are good, well-meaning, sacrificing individuals. There is a larger picture, and when you go to the United Nations, you're part of this larger picture. So that's just a little look at the perspective and to consider in your own self-understanding of being an NGO at the United Nations, how there can be different perspectives about NGOs. Now, here it's just quite a fascinating growth and development. I think right back in 1945, when first there were some NGOs, I think there was about a total of 41 that had any kind of formal relationship with the United Nations. And now in November, just a couple of days ago, 2010, there are 141 with general consultative status. There are 2,282 with special consultative status and 990 with consultative status. And then I've contacted DPI and to try to find out their latest numbers, but I have not got a reply from them. So to the best of my knowledge, at the moment, there's at least about 1,600 that are in association with DPI, but that number could be way off, and I will correct it as soon as I get more specific data on that one. That also just goes to show that there's been a significant growth in the number of NGOs that are seeking to be connected to the United Nations, and that's one of the factors that is also influencing the tone of some of the member states towards NGOs. As the numbers seriously increase, even the ECOSOC office that deals with NGOs, they are swamped by the numbers of applications. So that's even changing their process. They almost never now automatically give an NGO general consultative status. They will at best give them special consultative status, and then if they prove themselves worthy, then in time they'll upgrade them to general consultative status. But most don't start out there. Whereas 10, 15 years ago, an NGO was worthy of it, they would give that general status immediately. So even if an NGO appears to be worthy of that status right at the get-go at their application, they won't necessarily do it today. Again, it just means to say what is going on at the United Nations influences the responses and the actions of the member states. Now, NGOs can make their statements to the United Nations, and this is an example of one of the organizations that I've worked with. As mentioned previously, NGOs in consultative status can submit and have their statements become UN documents. Now, here I want to talk about and introduce what I call East River politics. If you've ever been down the East River, that thin, narrow piece of water that lies between Manhattan and Long Island right there, you'll know that when the tide is running really hard, that water almost boils. It occurred to me that in so many ways, that's kind of the nature of some of the politics that are going on in the United Nations. And it is a form of fluid dynamics. It's a turbulent fluid dynamics. Now, why point this out? I wanted to provide you with a visual representation of the main dimensions of the context that NGOs encounter at the United Nations. A lot of what goes on behind that peaceful row of flags and that tall building that is currently being renovated. You've got a UN framework with its specific structures and procedures and rules and regulations. It's got its different areas of responsibility and capacity or whatever. You've got NGOs making their efforts with their own agendas, coming in and meeting at this place. You've got member states with their mandates from their capitals and their politics between and amongst one another. And then add to all of this, you've got public opinion, you've got the media, you've got what's going on in the world influencing and impacting the nature of those relationships within this small little campus of the United Nations. It's a wonderful and intense, exciting, and when you get beneath the surface, the diplomatic surface that is always very nice, very appropriate, very kind, well-spoken, there are so many issues and dynamics at play. That makes it an exciting and a challenging and a really almost fun place to work if you're ready to really step up, learn, and engage. The good thing about all of this is you won't drown like if you fall in the East River, you might. But if you jump into this East River politics, sometimes being naive about a lot of stuff is a wonderful place to start and immerse yourself in the United Nations and its work. So next, what have we got? We've got some homework. All I want to do here very quickly is go to that link that I gave you on IGOs and just take some time to look through that and see if there are any other IGOs that deal with your NGO's area of concern. Take 5 short minutes just to look around. Again, part of this is to just get you more comfortable and familiar with this international environment that you are stepping more boldly into. And I'm, again, just honored that I can immerse you in some of this so that it can provide you with some of these shortcuts of understanding, perspective, and insight, that your journey can be not only thrilling and exciting, stimulating, rewarding, you can begin to feel like you know the United Nations so much better than so many other people out there. I can guarantee that you will. And in the next lesson, I'm going to introduce you to grounding from which you can learn and apply many of the things that we begin to go over in these next few days. So this is it for lesson number 2. I really look forward to getting into the next one. It's so much fun, and I'm excited to be with you, and I hope that you are too. Don't forget, at the bottom of this, do add your comments and questions, or jot down your questions and keep them ready for our question and answer session later on this month. Thank you very much, and I look forward to seeing you tomorrow.